City, John Grayson, Rob Ross here with you once again, and once again, plenty to talk about as we are doing our first official broadcast of the new year, although I know we've got a couple that have been up there since then, but here we are now into almost the middle of January, and Rob, what's going on in New York?
Well, we just got hit with a quote-unquote bombogenesis.
I love that word.
That's as good as covfefty.
Right.
You know, because it makes absolutely no sense to me whatsoever. And, of course, you know how I get about people raping and pillaging my beloved English language.
Uh-huh. Well, and the thing is, you know, we had seen Superstorm Sandy. I mean, there have been a few things that have gone on along the Eastern Seaboard that were really, really nasty. And I talked to a friend of mine in Ocean City, Maryland on Friday, and he said, yeah, you know, it was bad enough. They got a foot of snow, and that's something they don't normally see. But it's different. I mean, when a storm really comes in and does major, major damage, it's not the same thing as just getting a lot of snow.
Right. And what we got was not a lot of snow, especially in New York City.
Right.
It was high winds. It was bitter cold. But it was nowhere near the snowmageddon that the media was making it out to be. The fact that schools were closed, I don't think it should have been as such, because it really puts a great deal of strain on the parents who are left scrambling.
Right.
You know, I think it was far more important that that places like, Savannah and I think Charleston were severely hit by snow, and they don't have the tools to get themselves dug out with ease the way New York does. They don't have these salt dropping machines already salting the streets at the first signs of snow and so on and so forth. That's problematic. New York, once again, has become this, I don't know, this sort of nanny town. And everybody's got to be babied and mollycoddled.
Right.
We're New Yorkers. You know, you're from Buffalo, for Christ's sakes. You got it worse than I ever did. I
mean, yeah.
Shit, we're both a hardy bunch, but damn it. You know what. A 2-foot snowdrop is like on a regular basis in winter.
Well, and it's not just the weather, it's everything. I mean, I'm pretty sure you can handle a 32-ounce soda. I'm just going out on a limb here, granted, but I'm pretty sure you can handle that, and so can everybody else in New York if they choose to. But it's that kind of thing, and it's been over and over and over again. So when everybody comes in and says, oh, don't go outside if it's snowing, then it kind of goes into that same category of really, I'll be fine. I'll watch out for my own ass. You just stay out of it.
Surprise, surprise. You know, it was the second day at my new job, and you know what? I had no problems taking the ferry, no problem getting the subway. I got to work on time. I was able to find lunch with no problem, and I got home at a normal time.
Yeah, it's probably easier than it normally is because you didn't have to deal with half the people who listened to them when they said stay home.
Well, that was the beautiful part. I mean, the street was empty when I was walking to the ferry, and the ferry itself was quiet.
Yeah.
Friday was a bit colder. It was sunny, which was great. You know, yes, there was ice, so you wear the appropriate shoes, you walk with caution.
Right.
And again, there was no problem. So, you know, I don't know what the hell's happened to people, but you better man up, society, because you are going straight to hell with the way you're going.
Now, as it stands right now, you mentioned Buffalo, and we're now just, as we're recording this, about a half an hour away from the Bills being beaten out of the playoffs by the Jacksonville Jaguars. And, again, I hate to keep harping on the same old thing, but the NFL has no idea. Still, I mean, instant replay has been in use in the NFL for something like 20 years, and they still have no idea how to be consistent with its use. And once again, you know, really, to put it bluntly, the Bills got fucked again.
Well, the one play that I saw, the very end play that ended the game.
Right.
I clearly saw it. Even the guys in the booth saw it. The
ball hit the ground. The ball was moving in his hands. Sure.
Mm-hmm. That's not a catch.
Right. And a few plays earlier than that, they called back a 3rd-and-10 play that would have been a first down. And they said Charles Clay stepped out of bounds. Well, I've seen that thing now 10 times, and I still can't tell you for certain that he stepped out of bounds. But that they were able to overturn because it went in the other team's favor. So I hate it. I hate it that this is what the game has come down to.
Well, be it football, certainly be it the NHL, and baseball, although baseball still hasn't figured out how to get get it right yet, because it seems to take them 20 minutes
right
to make a decision on a call on the field. It's officiating is just piss poor.
Yeah.
That's really all there is to it. And that goes for all the major sports. So I watch now with a sense of almost skepticism, because I know sooner than later, one of those referees, umpires, linesmen are going to make a shit call. And that shit call is going to probably cost my team, be it the Rangers, the Jets, or the Mets.
Right. And it's going to cost them a game, and may very well, at least in the NFL, because it can all hinge on one game, may very well cost them a shot at the playoffs. So the beat goes on as far as that's concerned. Speaking of the beat going on, though, there is some good news this week, and we haven't done this in a while. We made mention of this last time around, that it had been a while since there had been new music worth talking about. This time around, we've got not one, but two, and I want to kick off with a band that you were kind enough to review on Popdos called The Get Ahead. Because if there is a, if there's a real place, and I believe that there is, for this very kind of return to lo-fi, that mid-70s kind of sound, these guys really have a feel for it, and in the best possible way, especially right at the beginning of the song that you have linked on the page, which is the title track from Mind is a Mountain. It's got such a great feel to it. It's gravelly and scratchy, and it just, it sounds right.
It sounds right, and it sounds, more importantly, like what you and I love, a band playing together
yep.
as a band in a room.
Right.
You know, and playing at the same time. They're playing the live track instead of individually and apart and using auto-tune and digi this and, you know, whoop-de-doo that. It's a really good, strong EP. I was taken aback at how much I liked it. That's kind of a sad statement that I would actually be surprised by liking something new. But there's also just a lot of genuine soul and feel coming out of this EP.
Talk to me, brother, I need to hear your voice. Your mind is a mountain. Mind is the mountain. Talk to me, brother, I need to hear your voice. Your mind is a mountain. Mind is the mountain.
You know, the songs are all they're all fully realized. They're all very fleshy. You know, there's great harmonies, and those guys can play.
Right. And the writing is intelligent. It's everything that it should be. It's intelligent writing. It means something. And the vocals on it, as you said, not just the harmonies, but the lead singer, this guy's got a fantastic voice. He's really easy to listen to.
Yeah. I mean, there's, I don't want to go too deep into the whole 70s kind of comparisons, even though, yeah, definitely it's got a 70s feel to it. If I was going to say anything, it definitely has a reminiscence of those kind of swampy records that we dug from the early 70s, mixed in with some of the Stax Memphis Soul vibe.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's a track on there called To the Wild, and it sounds a lot like the Staple Singers. You know, if you close your eyes, you can imagine that kind of gospel chorale opening it. You know, and you feel that tingle going up your spine.
Yeah, and it, you know, again, it just works. It's very comfortable music, and it sounds good, and it's clear that they've been doing this for long enough to get a real good feel for each other. So check out Mind is a Mountain from The Get Ahead. Before we get to the next band, there was one other thing that that crossed the desk this week, because you mentioned that swampy kind of feel, and one of the guys who was responsible for building that is the guy that, well, brought the world the Swampers. And the man who began Fame Studios in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and was responsible in a lot of ways for that Muscle Shoals sound. Rick Hall is an interesting character in rock and roll, but he's also certainly got his place in its history. He died this week at age 85. For folks who are not that familiar with the differences between the Memphis sound and the Muscle Shoals sound, explore that a little bit and talk about what Rick Hall meant.
For a start, the guys in Muscle Shoals, they were all white guys.
Yep.
I mean, that's just a fact. You know, you heard these records and you thought, is that Booker T and the MGs? You know, is that, you know, who is it the Funk Brothers? You know, is it, who is that? It's just these white kids who were locals.
Right.
The Swampers were all local white kids. And, you know, Rick Hall was their mentor, their guide. He was the one who built and created Fame Studios in Muscle Shoals. The thing is that he, through his, I guess it was a contract with Atlantic Records. Since Atlantic had severed its ties with Stax, Atlantic took its acts, like Aretha Franklin and Wilson Pickett, down to Muscle Shoals.
Yeah.
With Jerry Wexler, so that way they could basically recreate and, or if you want to be really blunt about it, rip off the Stax sound, the Stax feel. The thing is, they did it incredibly well. And the Swampers were just some bad motherfuckers of players. Those guys were untouchable.
Right. And they were as automatic as, you know, we've spent so much time talking about the Wrecking Crew and the fact that the reason why those guys were hired again and again and again is because they were automatic. You put the charts in front of them and said, play this, and one take and they were done. And the Swampers, to all recollection, were exactly the same way. You wanted them to do exactly what they did on the last take, they would replay it for you note for note.
If I'm not mistaken, it's the Swampers who are the backup band to Dusty Springfield on Dusty in Memphis,
yep,
which is kind of a misnomer name for the album anyway.
Right.
You know, and you think about that. You think about the songs. You think, of course, about Son of a Preacher Man, which is a song I absolutely loathe. But think about the timbre of it. Think about the feel, the arrangement, the sound, the punchiness, the
right
vibe. Well, these white kids down in Muscle Shoals are the ones who batted that out.
Yeah.
Under the tutelage and guidance of Rick Hall. Although he was known for being something of an irascible kind of character, and that belies, you know, therein lies the whole story, the balance of, you know, how he was very good at pissing off the people he really shouldn't have been pissing off.
Right.
Frankly.
Right. And at the same time, he was, I mean, I can vouch for that at least a little bit because I had the chance to talk to him a couple of years ago. Two things happened at the same time. His book came out and a documentary that was sort of loosely based on the book were released about Muscle Shoals. And both of them were fantastic. But I had the chance to spend about 25 or 30 minutes talking to Rick Hall at that point. And he very much gave off the vibe that he loved the music. He loved what he had been able to put together there. But he was kind of spiky, you know. I'll give it to the guy. He did some amazing work, but he was not the kind of warm storyteller that you hear a lot from you know, guys who were in the music industry back there. The one thing I think, though, that he had more than anything else was the ability to spot talent, because when you have people who just walk up out of nowhere, like, oh, I don't know, Dwayne Allman, who became a serious big part of what they were able to put together down there, and you say, all right, kid, go ahead, get in there and show us what you've got. And you had guys walk out of the cotton fields. Was it Otis Redding who got his start there?
No, it was Wilson Pickett.
Wilson Pickett, that's right. And he was nobody.
And Wilson Pickett was paired with Dwayne Allman.
Right.
They became the best of friends, and, you know, they're the ones who created their particular sound.
Right.
You know, certainly on the Wicked Pickett's records. But you know what? The thing is, though, even though Rick Hall did have that kind of I know best and fuck you all kind of attitude, he definitely did have the begrudging respect of the people, even the people he managed to piss off, like his own in-house band, which is why they all started to leave on their own and build their own studio, competing with Rick Hall directly right down the road.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, again, because it's such a tiny little town, some of those wounds still were very much open at the time. I mean, Rick Hall was not the kind who was going to forgive and forget that kind of thing, but right, he still had the respect for those guys, for the Swampers and what they were able to play.
Rick Hall was basically the anti-Jim Stewart. You know, Jim Stewart, right, of course, who was the founder of Stax Records, is possibly one of the most beloved of all, you know, record people, you know, bar none. And along with that would go John Frey, God rest his soul, from Arden Studios. You say the name and you say it with almost a sense of reverence.
Yeah.
You know, these were people who were loved. Rick Hall was respected, not so much loved.
Exactly, right. And respected right up until his death, which happened just a couple of days ago. Now, we move back into the music, and it's funny because you mentioned with the Get Ahead that it was kind of almost an apologetic, I really liked this record. With the next one we're going to talk about, a band called the Lucille Furs out of Chicago, I saw the picture that you have on the page, and I thought, oh no, here we go again. These guys, one of them's wearing a poncho, and everybody's in paisley, and oh, we're going to pretend it's 1967 again. And I was totally ready to write them off and say, here's another band who just wants to essentially do what Oasis did, which is relive the past and bring nothing new to the table. And I was completely wrong. Who are the Lucille Furs?
Okay, first of all, I'm glad you were completely wrong, especially after saying Oasis, because if there's anything Oasis couldn't do, the only thing Oasis couldn't do was not rip off the Beatles.
Right, right, exactly. But nothing new.
Just a fucking awful band, and I don't know why people love them so much. There's nothing redeeming about them, period. So I'm just going to veer away from anything as far as Oasis is concerned. So the Lucille Furs, which is an – I'm not sure if I like the name, but they're from Chicago. There we go.
Yeah. You know.
They're a band out of Chicago, and all I'm going to say is this. Like you, I was almost predisposed and preordained to want to dislike them because of that. Oh, you got to be kidding. Look at those hairdos. Look at that picture. Who do you think you are? And the thing is, when I think of 1967 and I think of, you know, certain elements of psychedelia, I think of Syd Barrett's Pink Floyd.
Right.
I think of the Monkees, Circa, Pisces, Aquarius, you know. I think of, you know, genuinely psychedelic stuff.
Yeah, even right. The beginnings of like Iron Butterfly and all of that, sure.
Right. And then, of course, there are moments I'll think of things like, you know, the Nas and Count Five, even though I know Count Five is from 66. But, you know, it's that whole kind of feeling. The thing is that the Lucille Furs got all of that right.
Yeah.
As I said in my review, if you mash together the feel and the sound of the Nas with the musicianship and skills of the Left Banc and the vocal arrangements of something like the New Colony 6, especially since they were from Chicago, and a lot of the Piper at the Gates of Dawn, you've got it.
Yeah.
They've got it. And it's just an odd thing because you're sitting there fighting an already instilled bias. I think that's what made it even better. I love it when I'm wrong. Right. I love to be wrong when I hear something just because I hear the name and I see the picture and I go, no.
Uh-huh.
No, I'm thrilled that I was wrong because it's such a good and consistent album. It starts with a track, and I love the titles too. It starts with a track called The Fawn of Teal Deer. But as soon as I heard it, and I heard the harpsichords, my immediate thought was Grimly Fiendish by the Damned.
Yeah, you know, okay.
Weird and spiky, but so was that track. But there's also a lot of the Jefferson Airplane in this album.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a band you don't hear, or it doesn't even have the country feel, but the more rockin' feel of the Moby Grape. And nobody really stops to think about those bands anymore as being a part of an influential, whatever you want to call it, a germ, you know, being planted. It's just those names are forgotten.
I mean,
How many people do you know actually can cite the Jefferson Airplane as an influence?
Yeah, not many, but you can definitely hear it in this, not only in the way that the music is played, not only in the way that the songs are constructed. And one of the things that impressed me about them, and it's something we've talked about before, with young bands, it's very difficult for them to get a feel for how to fill up a song without overfilling a sound, without having it just, you know, squirting out at the edges and it's just all too much. There was a very deft hand behind this one. The production of it sounds fantastic, as does the playing itself and the writing of the songs.
And the vocals and the harmonies and the arrangements, everything about it is right. I mean, you know, this album also has something we never get to really talk about when you think about it, especially in the modern parlance, songs with riffs.
Right.
Riffs don't exist anymore.
Yep.
And there's a track called Pink Noise because it's got a strong riff. And it also kind of turns it into an instant masterpiece by virtue of the very on-point 60s harmonies. Another track, Baby, I'm presuming it's pronounced Baby Blaze. It sounded like the Turtles when they were getting psychedelic. You know, during the very late parts of the Happy Together album slash period, or the Battle of the Bands album, because every song on that album sounded different. Because it was supposed to be played by different bands. Mm-hmm. And so they did it in the different permutations they had been before they became the Turtles. You know, that's how much I think these guys actually may have studied what they were doing. Because they seem to take an awful lot of cues that are very, very obscure. If they don't know about any of this stuff, then more power to them.
Right.
The good taste. But then at the same time, there's – well, first of all, the song that's the real standout is also the video – Our Lady of Perpetual Frustration.
Yeah.
I mean, just that's a wow track. That's a – take my word for it. If you haven't heard it yet, listen to it. If you haven't seen it, watch it. It's brilliant on every level.
Yeah.
Period.
The one nitpick I have – and I actually have it with that track because you're right. It's a great song and it's one of those you could listen to over and over and over again without getting sick of it. But they had an opportunity to do something. And this again goes back to the production more than it does the playing. There was a studio trick that they used to use a lot back then with the stereo. And the way they have this song cut up with the rhythm guitar almost all the way over on one side and back in the background just a little bit is great. What they should do, I think, and maybe this is something you know they can work on for future albums, is when that sound becomes what's in the forefront, move it there. Move it into the center. Take it out of the right channel, move it into the center a little bit more, bring it a little bit more up to the front, and that's the kind of thing that really can make a tremendous amount of difference. It's something most people wouldn't even notice. They would just think the song sounds better.
No, I'm going to take a guess and say, you know, it's the first foray into
right.
studio.
Right.
You know, maybe they weren't aware of this just yet. But I think the one really staggering moment for this record, though, there's a track called, and I love the way it's titled because of the way the title is written, Between Us Two - I Saw You. I love the way that that's kind of like laid out.
Yeah. Yeah.
It sounds birdsy during that Younger Than Yesterday period, you know, think Crosby Birds, think, you know, Mind Gardens and you know, Everybody's Been Burned and that kind of stuff. It's a cross between, and because it's got that hypnotic sounding 12 string, the Birds and the Rain Parade.
Yeah.
Because this would unquestionably have fit on Emergency Third Rail Power Trip. There's no doubt in my mind. This track, definitely.
Yeah.
So I am very cautiously hopeful for more good to great things from both the Get Ahead and especially from Lucille Furs.
Definitely. So be watching out for both of them. The review is up on the page elsewhere on Popdos. And a couple of things to make mention of from the sad goodbyes section of our show this week. We mentioned already Rick Hall, but he wasn't the only one that we lost. And it's funny how word of this has sort of trickled out that a member of the Moody Blues died.
Yeah. Shockingly, I only heard today, this morning, that Ray Thomas, the band's vocalist, songwriter, flautist, percussionist, passed away on Thursday. And yet the news wasn't released, I guess, as as a standard statement to the world until this morning, because that's when I started to see it filtering around, and I checked Wikipedia and everything just to make sure that, yeah, that was unfortunately real.
Yeah.
The cruel irony of this is that the last 2 weeks, because a friend of mine had mentioned the Moody Blues, it got me back into re-listening to them and revisiting them, because I was heavily, and I mean heavily, into them around 1978 or so. I mean, I just loved that band, you know, and I have to admit, I was not crazy about the original Denny Lane version of the band, the one that did Go Now and Stop and My Baby's Gone and Bye Bye Bird and all that. You know, once I think the master stroke for them certainly was to bring in, you know, Justin Hayward and John Lodge. But those first singles with Justin Hayward, the first two, which no one ever seems to have either heard or remembers, Fly Me High, which is tremendous, and Leave That Man Alone, just two fantastic songs, and what a great way to segue into the second half of your career. But the thing is, Ray Thomas kind of got shuffled to the background, because at the outset he was the co-lead singer and he played maracas. That was it. But at this point now, he starts to write songs, as everyone in the band does. And with the exception, of course, of Days of Future Past, because it's a concept album that's got on it Tuesday Afternoon and, of course, Nights in White Satin, you get to In Search of the Lost Chord, 1968, which has on it, of course, Ride My Seesaw and yep. Legend of a Mind, a.k.a. Timothy Leary Is Dead. But that album has possibly my favorite Moody Blues track, which was written by Ray Thomas, Dr. Livingston, I presume, which is, it's like a song, a story written in three parts, the kind of thing you and I love. It's almost like a precursor to the whole, you know, Band on the Run concept.
With, right,
you know,
right.
You've got one song here, break into the next song, break back into the next part, you know. Just absolute genius. And he also wrote one of the most gorgeous and haunting things that band ever did, Lazy Day, which came off on the threshold of a dream. So I'm very shocked and very sad. It's the kind of news I really didn't want to have on my birthday, to be quite honest with you. I could do without that, you know.
Yeah.
But on the positive side of things, and here I'd like to spin it to some good news that I heard this morning. Over this weekend, out in Portland, there have been charity shows held to try and raise more money for Scott McCoy of Young Fresh Fellows, REM, The Baseball Project, and so on, after he'd suffered a stroke just about a month and a half ago.
Yeah.
Well, apart from the fact that those two shows were beyond sellout successes and money poured in, and they've made a very healthy, ample amount of funds to be able to keep him sustained while he's rehabbing, you had on that stage at the same time Peter Buck, Mike Mills, and Bill Berry.
Nice.
Okay, performing REM songs.
Yeah, of course.
By the way, Peter Buck was playing an Epiphone Wilshire.
Huh, okay.
one of the little clips I saw.
Great little guitar, yeah.
More importantly, Scott McCoy himself was up there on the stage. He seems to have recuperated. He's made dramatically wonderful positive progress and was able to get on stage, play some bass, sing some backing vocals, but he was able to be there, which I think is a fantastic thing. It says a lot about the human spirit. So
yeah.
There at least is some positive news to temper off the already sad news that we're sharing in 2018.
Right. No doubt. And yeah, that's excellent news all the way around. So again, hoping for the best. And the other news out of Portland, Oregon for this week, by the way, was that they passed a law, or rather repealed a law, in 36 of the counties in the state of Oregon that up until then, it's the same way that I guess it still is in New Jersey.
Pump your own gas.
Right. Where you have to pump your own gas. So all of a sudden, 36 counties have self-serve for the first time ever, and they've got a population of people who have never had to put gas in their own car, and it's amazing to watch on Twitter how few of them can actually do it.
Well, you have to understand something. You have to be able to be a functioning human being instead of a complete and utter fucking nimrod. I know it takes a lot to conceive of, as you put your phone down, you put the car in park.
Right.
You turn your phone off because it says very clearly at the gas pumps. See, living in New York where it's quasi-civilized,
right.
We can pump our own gas. It says cell phones must be turned off. I know that's hard for most people to conceive of, but try it. Trust me, you don't want to go boom in a gas station. That's number one. Number two, you put the car in park, you turn off the engine, you get out of the car, you open the gas tank. I know you have to look for it sometimes. It's usually found on either the driver's side or the passenger side.
And on every American car and most Japanese cars for the last 30 years, right there on the gas gauge, there's been a little arrow that points to which side of the car the gas door is on.
Right. And also, if you have to unlock it from within, there's usually a little lever that's on the floor that has a gas pump on it.
Right. Imagine that.
You just go like this. You can't see me, but I'm just lifting the lever slightly. It's kind of like flipping an on and off switch halfway. Right?
Uh-huh.
And then it pops open, and lo and behold, there's a thing called a gas cap. And you unscrew it. It's like a large bottle top. Okay? Once you do that, now here's the tricky part with self-serve. You may have to actually go up to the gas station attendant and say, I would like $20 of gas on pump number 8. Look for the big number sticker that's on the gas pump.
Right.
Okay? Once you do that and you've paid it, and the guy will usually just turn on the pump, and that way by the time you get back to the gas pump, you squeeze it, and you can hear liquid coming out. That's called gasoline, and it's going into your gas tank.
And
you'll see numbers rolling, and that's on the top, it means how many gallons are going in, and on the bottom means how much. And usually because it's pre-programmed, if you say $20, it'll stop by the time it reaches $20, so you don't have to worry.
Right. And not only that, but if you go ahead and fill the entire tank, when it gets full, it stops by itself. It doesn't go squirting out all over you.
It's a thumping noise.
Yeah. These people, they're all terrified. And nobody can figure out how to do it. And I've seen tweets from people saying, what if I spill it on me? I'll smell like gasoline all day. Well, here's a clue. Don't spill it on you.
Or better off, do us a favor. If you find that you've gotten yourself doused in gasoline and you smell, you may want to burn the smell off very quickly. Strike a match.
Yeah, right. There's nothing to it. But there is one other thing about that, because there have been people already who have reportedly ruined their car's engines by doing things like putting E85 in a car that doesn't take E85.
What's E85?
E85, it's something you probably see a lot more in the Midwest here because this is corn country. All gasoline has a percentage of ethanol in it to try to prop up the corn industry. Usually it's about 5%. Sometimes it could be as high as 15 and still call itself gasoline, which is fine for most cars. It screws up early fuel injectors like from the 80s because there's too much aluminum in them, but not to get too pedantic. E85 is a special grade that's 85% ethanol, 15% gasoline. The reason they do that is because those cars technically could run on pure ethanol, but pure ethanol gets gummy when it gets cold out. So they have to mix in some gasoline just to make sure it'll stay liquid. So you have to have a special car. Now, my car has a yellow gas cap, which means I can use E85 in my car. But if you have one that's supposed to run on gasoline and you run it on E85, you're going to screw up the engine. So already there are people doing that kind of thing. Here's the thing, though. Funny thing about E85 is that it's usually about 20 cents a gallon cheaper than regular gasoline is. The other thing about it is it's not as energy dense. So filling your tank full of E85 won't take you as far as filling your tank full of gasoline. It's about 15% less efficient. So usually the difference in price is only about 4 or 5%. So using E85 is cheaper to fill your tank with, but it costs you more in the long run.
I see. Interesting to know.
Yeah.
Interesting. You know, all I can say is this. If you haven't figured out how to pump gas and, you know, you're quote unquote not in a wheelchair, blind, legally blind, or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have a culling of the, you know, because, you know, these are the people that just need to be put down. It's fucking gasoline. Learn how to pump it, you dumb fucks.
Right.
And stop bitching about it, you pussies.
You know, and I found out because of this that a lot of the places here in town, if they are self-serve only, which there's only probably a half a dozen places around here that still even have full serve as an option. But the ones that are self-serve only, the pumps, there's a call button on the pumps. So if you are in a wheelchair or you are elderly and can't get around as well, they'll come out and pump it for you for free.
Right. There's that's a difference. That's also an exception.
Right. Right. Exactly.
But if you're a fully capable asshole who shouldn't even be driving because you probably drive like shit anyway.
Right.
I'm sure you make turns without a signal, which is probably one of my biggest bugaboos. Then I just want to have you put down.
Yeah.
Not humanely, because I'm not for humanely doing away with people. You know, I'm definitely for all just taking them all out into the center of the town square and shooting them in the back of the head execution style. Enough. I've had enough of the pussification of humanity. When is it going to stop? These assholes in Portland can't pump gas. These idiots in New York don't want to go out. Hey, it's a little bit wet and cold out.
Yeah. We need to stay inside. Well, and on top of that, I'm sure you've seen the commercial by now because it's got the Star Wars theme to it of the girl that's in the car. And the car has the system that will put itself back in the lane for you. You know, it'll make little steering adjustments and things like that. And she's driving through a whole bunch of AT-ATs, the big troop carrier Empire things. And there's a big battle going on around her, and she makes it safely through. And the problem is that system is teaching people how to be shitty drivers.
That and the fact that there's no fucking way a car is going to get past an AT-AT.
Yeah, right.
Who are we both getting here?
Uh-huh.
You know the firepower of those things.
Right, right. So,
you know, it took a bunch of, you know, what do you call it, dwarfism suffering bears and a dumb Wookiee to hijack a couple of them and take over. Okay, fine. Now, granted, the Empire's army is not that great. But if you were and I were running one of those AT-ATs, you think anybody would get past us?
No.
Not a fucking chance.
Exactly. Yeah, no, it wouldn't happen. And you know, my wife told me a story already because her dad has been a master mechanic now for, I don't know, 50 years or something like that. And she said that he had a guy bring in a BMW, go figure, because the pricks are on the inside, that had that system. And he brought it in for repairs, and it was there for about a week. And the guy called. He had a loaner. It was a Volvo. And he had a loaner car, and a guy called up, and he says, I need my car back. I need that system. I can't drive without it. So already people are dependent on the car keeping itself in the lane for them. You know, I always thought that was what the steering wheel was for.
Right. It's called the steering wheel.
Pay fucking attention.
Gas pedal and also the brakes.
Right.
Because you don't want to get too close to the car in front of you. Because that's called another car. And also potential lawsuit.
Right.
And you also have to call it looking straight ahead, not looking at a phone, not texting. Not,
yeah.
Two hands on the wheel. Now, I will grant you, I'm not a big fan of the 10 to 2. Did you, when you learned to drive, did you do 10 to 2?
Yeah, and they say not to do that anymore because of the airbags. Yeah.
It's first of all, 10 to 2 is stupid as it's inefficient. I do it more like 4:30 to, you know, no, five, no, four, about 4:25 to 7:40.
Yeah, it'll keep you from breaking your arms if the airbag goes off. So
it's ridiculous. But the whole thing is pay fucking attention to the road.
Right.
Pay fucking attention to everything around you. Your senses are supposed to be focused on one thing and one thing only, driving.
Yeah.
If you got a bunch of miserable little shit kids in the car, don't. You do what you're supposed to do. When you were a kid and I was a kid, you pull the car over, you slap the shit out of them until they're quiet, and then you get on your way.
That's right.
And so one of these little namby-pamby bastards of yours starts going, yeah, parental abuse, and he hit me. I brought you into this world. I can take you out of it.
That's right.
And no court is going to convict me.
I will.
All these fucking lefty goddamn liberal courts with their bullshit towards kids. Fuck the kids.
I will turn this car around and you will never see Mickey Mouse, you little bastard. Yeah.
I fucking hate Mickey Mouse. What are you going to do about it, huh?
Speaking of Mickey Mouse.
Fritz the cat instead.
Oh, yeah. And actually, that gives me the opportunity to promo this for later on in the broadcast, because the In Our Heads segment is actually going to take place this time around at the movies rather than with music where we've normally been. But we'll get to that. And it actually has something to do with Mickey Mouse, because we saw something this week that was really...
I hope you weren't watching ISIS-inspired propaganda cartoons about the Jewish rat that kills little Palestinian children.
No, not quite that crazy, but still an interesting film that's been bouncing around out there. So we'll see what happens come Oscar time. But Yeah, the other thing, speaking of ISIS and all of the other crap that's been going on, is
we'll get to the segment about our president.
Yeah, the book. So the book came out. This book, Fire and Fury, that Michael Wolff wrote and quoted Steve Bannon as saying that everything that the Trump Jr. and the rest of them had done was treasonous, which, of course, Bannon, being the pussy that he is already backed off of and said, oh, I didn't mean him. I was only talking about Manafort. Yeah, that's a nice safe cover. Take the guy who's already under indictment. So all of this crap is going on. And, of course, Donald Trump can't help himself. He has to keep tweeting himself into a corner. So, I mean, the president looks like a 3-year-old again. I guess, really, not much has changed.
Nope. His first week of 2018 has been an unmitigated PR disaster.
Yep.
I do want to say one thing, though, because somebody posted a picture of Sarah Huckabee Sanders, indeed even, quote-unquote, her name.
Ugh.
On Facebook, and I'm telling you, she's in dire need of a shave. That's a fucking man. I'm sorry. Wow.
Ugly
fucking bitch, man.
Every time I see her, I think of Ludo from Labyrinth. Smell bad.
I'm telling you right now, she just... Remember when we were kids? Of course you remember. As soon as I say, all I have to do is say Witch Hazel.
Yeah,
and, you know that... She may not be very pretty now, but she was somebody's baby once. Well, you know what? She's probably a repulsive baby because not all babies are cute. Some of them are quite hideous, and you want to drown them.
Well, and look at her father, for crying out loud. What a freak that guy looks like.
Well, anyway.
Yeah.
He's a fucking inbred Jed, but her? I mean, her fucking face wasn't even glued together right.
Right.
Yeah. Jesus fucking Christ. Ugh. She's all lopsided. Her head is fucking lopsided. Get a level, I'm telling you.
And so is her brain. So that's the part that really affects the rest of us, is that it's just such horseshit coming out of these people day in and day out. And, you know, you wonder when this spinning out of control is actually going to hit the wall. It's only a matter of time. It's going to happen, but how it happens and when it happens are the only two things that are still up in the air.
It's got to be something that is going to have to be absolutely unrefutable, because unfortunately, and you've seen it and I've seen it and so has this country, everything that apparently comes out and attacks Donald Trump, there seems to be a counter.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the tennis ball going back and forth. He seems to be able to volley back. And, of course, he volleys back in a way that, even if, for argument's sake, what he's saying is, as per usual, an unmitigated lie, he puts the question in your brain that, well, remember when so-and-so said that and it turned out to be a lie?
Right.
Well, this is more of the same thing. He automatically gets you questioning it. Now, I have to say, the press have done a fantastic job into playing right into his hands.
Sure.
Because I questioned some of Michael Wolff's claims. I saw him in an interview the other night, and he seemed a little bit on the squirrely side. You know, can we lay complete – I don't want to say faith in a book, because there is no such thing as faith in a book, no matter how you slice it.
Mm-hmm.
It's always going to have some kind of bias in it. Regardless,
right?
How does one go about approaching this book? Do you read it like it's a wonderful piece of tabloid fluff, a la Jacqueline Suzanne, or who was the one who wrote Scruples? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
just basically a shitty, dirty book about a shitty, dirty guy.
Jackie Collins, right?
No, she wrote fluffier stuff. No, it was a. She's a blondish kind of woman who looked like Sally Jesse Raphael. That's all I can remember. They're all Jewy anyway, but besides that, you know, the thing with Trump is that...
Judith Kranz, that's who it was.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. See? The word Jew is in there.
Yeah.
And what would a show be like going by without me throwing in Jew?
Uh-huh.
Some Jew. You know, it's like you posting that thing that Stan Ridgway had said, but I immediately thought Randy Newman, simply because money.
Right.
And money. Jew. You know? Jew. a Jew? Money?
Yeah. You know, and it's funny how, you know, again, how oversensitive people have gotten. And I know this isn't news to anybody, but I was watching something. You go on Facebook enough and you're going to have these web videos pop up that either people are going to recommend for you or they just pop up and say, somebody you know is doing a Facebook Live video.
Right.
So I popped in on this thing and it was a television station in a town where I used to live, oddly enough, Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. And they were doing this broadcast with this guy who was like, he was a Christian youth minister or something like that. He was the guest on the show, but he was also a self-defense expert, which is kind of weird. But, you know, it was interesting enough to watch. And he kept going back to this, well, you know, you want to be able to disable somebody without hurting them and all of this. And he said, well, most of my stuff is based in jujitsu. So I posted up right after he said that. I said, I also practice jujitsu. I just make attackers feel guilty. And, you know, spelled it JEW/jitsu. And as soon as I put it up there, I get this, woman who comes out of nowhere. And that's inappropriate. And that's over the line. And I was like, lady, I'm a Jew. Fucking relax. And, you know, it was just crazy. You know, and the thing is, if you don't like it and you think it's over the line, fine. Just move on, you know?
Look at it this way. Okay, never mind the Jew thing, because we have an endless array of that.
Sure.
There's that woman who's a friend of yours or mutual friend of ours who posted that funny thing about the teacher, the fat cow, you know, yesterday. And yeah. Somebody had a fit with her over that.
Right.
It's not funny. It's inappropriate. It's like, lady, keep your fucking bloomers on, okay?
Yeah, right.
It's fucking funny.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. It just because you don't get it doesn't mean it isn't funny.
Right. The only thing that's genuinely not funny is 99% of anything that's English. They think they're funny. They're not.
Right.
They're not funny and not cute. Okay? They're fucking English. And by the way, speaking of Jew, I've seen, and I'm going to investigate this further, but apparently somebody has decided that they've had enough of Roger Waters and his Jew-hating ways. We're talking about promoting BDS as the dick tends to do. By the way, you can add another name to our You're Dead to Me list.
Yeah.
That dumb bitch, Lord. Apparently she
really?
Joined some BDS thing. So fuck her too.
Yeah.
Roger Waters is basically baiting everyone into Jew hating, never mind the anti-Israel BDS stance. So there is this thing that basically says, you know, to Roger Waters, and people are signing it.
Good.
So I'm very happy and heartened to see if this is in fact real. If it is, where do I sign?
Well, and
I will sign my name because I hate that motherfucker.
Well, yeah,
him and Brian Eno. Everybody says, "Oh, well, Brian Eno." No, fuck Brian Eno too. And the 3X Mrs. Eno is just like the 3X Mrs. Waters is. Will tell you the same thing.
Yeah. And the pros and cons of hitchhiking was 35 years ago. What have you done lately? So even outside of just him being an asshole, he hasn't produced anything.
Well, he has to go back and use his old Pink Floyd stuff because it's all he's got.
Right.
You know. And oh, by the way, Sid was still a better singer and songwriter than you're ever going to be.
Yep.
Ooh, watch him get all bent out of shape after he hears somebody say that. You know why? Because that's how he built a career.
Right.
You know, Sid's insanity. And yeah, we get it. Your father. Call a psychiatrist. Get over it.
And getting back to the Trump thing that kicked all of this off in the first place, I know what it is that's going to be the wall. I don't know when it's going to happen, but I know what's going to be the wall he's going to hit. Because up until now, he has shown an uncanny knack. I don't know if they're drugging him at breakfast or whatever they're doing, but between the time when he has his Twitter temper tantrum every morning and the time that he first shows up on camera, they are able to calm him down and get him to sound semi-rational in front of the TV cameras, where it's
careful
all
using that word rational.
So I said semi-rational. So what's going to happen is eventually there will be something that will get so far up his ass that he won't be able to stop himself and he will melt down in front of the TV cameras. And the minute he does that, that's when it's all going to go to hell.
So is it going to be like Nixon shoving what's his name?
Right. Something will go down, or he'll just start pounding the table and squealing about how they're all unfair to me and oh, how could they and all of this. And it's going to sound very petty and very crybaby, and it's okay. For some reason, his base doesn't give a shit if he does that on Twitter. They only care if he does it in person, if he does it on camera. And if that happens, it's over.
Okay, let's say for all things being equal, that does happen, where he does have the, you know, the big fat crybaby meltdown that people are basically saying he's been having all along off camera.
Yeah.
Does that then call for an actual congressional emergency meeting to have him removed from office because he is not capable of functioning in the role of president?
Right. Yeah, that's what's going to kick off Article 25. If nothing else does, that's what's going to finally do it.
I have to admit, I don't find that to be – I find that to be possibly the most – see, here it comes – the most rational and believable way of all, because you're not going to get him on Russia or collusion or anything else.
Right.
This whole thing is going to be a big fat red herring, because as usual, the left love to do this whole, oh, look at how great we are, we're still pushing this. Now shut the fuck up. You're not pushing anything except stupidity.
Yeah.
You're pushing your own – what you're doing is you're pushing yourself back into a corner, because while you're doing this and you're focusing on how wonderful you think you are, Bernie Sanders is still coming up the rear. And I mean that in every possible obscene way.
Okay? Yeah.
And number one, and you better start thinking about, you know, guess what? You have an election coming in a short amount of time. And I'm not talking about the midterms this year. You better get that old bastard off the table once and for all. Put him back in his fucking doghouse where he belongs.
Yeah, and not only that, and I hate to say it because I would kind of like to see it happen, but it's too late for Joe Biden. Stop talking about Joe Biden potentially making a run in 2020. He's going to be 76.
Enough with these old people already.
Right, exactly.
Stop it. This is not the 50s. This is not the 20s. You know? I mean, right. How old was Taft? Well, let's go back to the teens. How old was Taft when he became president? How old was Wilson when he became president? How old was Coolidge, Harding, Hoover, Roosevelt?
Right.
How old was that? Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower? These were all old men. And we don't want another repeat of, mommy, we don't need that.
Yeah.
Okay. If you're going to get an old man, bring back a dead president. I was good, and you knew I was – well, I wasn't a crook. I didn't do it. Enough.
Yeah.
Forward. Move forward. Move – if you want to talk about genuinely progressive, even though there's no such thing because that means they're all socialists, then let's get younger. Let's get better. You have to start actually looking for them.
Yeah, and growing them and teaching people how to do it. And that's what isn't happening right now, because they're all too, well, to again steal the line from Mel Brooks, they're all too busy trying to protect their phony baloney jobs. Speaking of which, while all of this riding high and all of the one thing that Donald Trump has been... Yeah, right. All of the stuff that Donald Trump has been patting himself on the back about, you know, the jobs. Oh, the economy is going great, and the Dow hit 25,000 for the first time ever, and blah, 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 blah. And then all of a sudden in December, this jobs report came out that was about 100,000 jobs short of where they thought it was going to be. And the Dow still continued to rise. It didn't take much notice of it. But now on the heels of that, and they said, well, more people laid off during the holidays than we thought were going to do it. And, you know, we don't know really what's behind this. But in these last couple of weeks, two major corporations have announced job cuts again. So clearly, I think it's easy to see that the same way that we've seen this bubble happen before, and we saw it happen with the dot-coms famously in the 90s, that we're building now a huge bubble in terms of stock prices that are based on not very much.
The fact is that when the dot-com bust and boom, or boom and bust, however you want to, you know, put it,
yeah,
it went both ways. That happened back in the – starting in the Clinton era, really.
Right.
Because almost as quickly as those first dot-coms appeared, they seemed to go out of business as quickly. Then you had – obviously, the years under Bush, where people were just losing their jobs hand over fist. You know, but under Obama, there was yet again more of the same boom and bust kind of thing happening. But also under Obama, you saw a greater number than before of brick and mortar companies calling it a day.
Right.
Which put people out of business not just the local stores or their chain store versions, but warehouse people who've worked for years and years. This is all a domino effect. And as of right now, we are heading towards an even greater wave of that, or perhaps maybe this is the last wave of the long time names finally going, you know, the way of the dodo, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah. Now, because Macy's was one of them. Yeah.
Right. Now, is that part of because of, you know, Trump's presidency? I don't really think so. I mean, he's certainly a symptom of everything that's wrong. But I think, unfortunately, certain companies have just run out of time, for lack of a better phrase, or time has caught up with them. I don't know how you want to really look at it, but Macy's just announced the loss of another oncoming 5,000 jobs and closing more stores. And today I read that Sears is in the process of shuttering even more, and they don't even have that many stores left.
Yeah.
I will give you a perfect example, locally speaking. Sears was one of the cornerstones of the Staten Island Mall. In fact, Macy's was the first store that opened up at the Staten Island Mall. We don't know the fate of that one yet, so that's still a question mark. I don't know what's going to happen with the Sears at the Staten Island Mall, but last year when Sears announced that they were doing the final closings of any Kmarts that were left, they were also going to start closing down more Sears. This Sears cut itself in half physically.
Yeah.
It used to be a two-floor store. Now it's just one very small floor. They had closed out the long-standing and very well-respected automotive center. You know, they sold off their key component brand name, Kenmore. There's nothing left.
Yeah.
You know, that's another one that JCPenney has still managed to kind of walk the balance beam, albeit precariously off balance, but they're still walking it is surprising to me, because they're another one that I would have thought would have been gone by now.
Yeah. Yeah. And we've seen this happen before. I mean, it's good for, in the short term, it's good for stock prices if you can show a better and healthier bottom line. And the way to artificially do that is to cut jobs, because by cutting salary, you make your earnings reports look better. But there's only so far that you can cut before your business falls apart. And that's, I think, what we're on the doorstep of with a lot of these things. And that's what's going to be, again, the death knell for them, is that the cuts will become too deep. They will get too addicted to, we can pump up the stock price and get a better retirement package by cutting more jobs. And they're going to realize we can't do business anymore. There's just not enough people to do it.
The thing is that once you lose your job, where do you go next? I'm more concerned with people who lose their jobs.
Yeah, who are they going to sell to? Sure.
You know, or what do you do when you've spent a lifetime in a certain company or certain – and here's another word that's suddenly becoming or working its way towards being extinct – industry.
Yeah.
You know, when we were kids, the whole thing was you go to school to learn a certain trade / industry, whether it's broadcast journalism, psychology – you know, public relations, the music industry. Public relations in the music industry have literally been wiped out.
Right.
You know, boutique firms pop up, and that's great, but, you know, music, major, quote, the quote, major labels that still exist, they still haven't learned their lesson yet. You know, they still need to have more stupid slapped out of them in a cruel way, and it's going to happen, I'm sure, and unfortunately other people are going to lose their jobs. But look, all the people that I knew, every one of them left the industry. Yep. There isn't anyone that still works for a record label at all, you know, or even remotely works in music or with a music company.
Yeah.
You know, because I think because we all grew up. I that's maybe that's cynical of me. I don't know. But, you know, the thing is, how long do you stay with something that certainly is not treating you right either?
Yeah, well, exactly. But, at, you know, you look at what people are doing instead, and people are becoming Uber drivers and taking part in this sort of this economy of scaling everything down to being your own boss, which in some ways is fine. But what they're realizing is that there's just not enough money in it. And somebody is always out there willing to undercut you.
Right, and something, there's also a fair amount of danger involved with Uber. There's something questionable about Uber's own management skills.
Right.
You know, they're one of those very nebulous companies.
Yeah. So,
and
something's going to have to change. And that, you know, what it's going to be and what the economy is going to look like a year from now, I think is going to be a very different world from where it is now. And it's probably going to go through something fairly painful to get there.
Well, I really hope that it doesn't happen the way that it's happened before.
Yep.
Because unfortunately, it takes an inordinately long time for people to be able to get back up on their feet. Usually not even close to what they'd been making previously. And, you know, if you're a reasonable person like you are, like I am, you don't find yourself mired in debt, thank God. Why? Because we're reasonable people. We're adults. We know what we need versus what we don't need. We don't spend on what we don't need, you know. Do we get a frivolity here and there every now and then? Yeah. Who's not entitled to that kind of thing? But if there are people still out there after all this time that don't understand the concept of control your impulses and compulsions, and you're still, you know, enmeshed in credit card debt,
yeah,
then whatever happens to you, you deserve. You should have known better, you know. That kind of stupidity and irresponsibility is unacceptable of an adult, certainly in our age bracket. But I would like to spin it back to one more positive thing on the musical front,
mm-hmm.
because this is something you enjoy as much as I do. You love a good guitar player. I love a good guitar player. And there's nobody we love more than Jeff Beck.
Oh, yeah.
And he is the master as far as I'm concerned. I remember you and I talked about last week, you know, watching guitar players who just constantly, you know, jerk off the guitar neck and, you know, all the flash and their own stupid histrionics and stage hogging presence just becomes tedious, and it takes away from the fluidity and quality of their playing.
Noodling.
Know?
Yeah, they just noodle. Sure.
Noodling is not passion. Noodling is just showing off. Jeff Beck, on the other hand, still goes out there and he plays with such fire and such passion. And it's kind of weird that his, quote, 60th anniversary, sorry, 50th, I don't want to age him that much, 50th anniversary show was held in 2016, when his 50th anniversary was when he joined the Yardbirds in 65. But okay, you know what? Semantics, schmantics. This wonderful DVD that came out, 50th anniversary celebration live at the Hollywood Bowl, is just a wonderful testimony to exactly how great Jeff Beck still remains. He still absolutely has it. You know, and the interesting thing is that he has a completely new band behind him on this particular performance. They were the band that joined up with him for his last studio album, and they're all really young. We're talking in their 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And it is just a phenomenal thing to watch that first of all, he's undertaking a great deal of trust to put into these young people. And you think about that juxtaposition of Jeff Beck, who's now been doing it for 50 years.
Right.
Has a catalog of albums that are just indescribable, and the arrangements and you have these young kids, and they are absolute crackerjack group of players. Absolutely stunning. So that made it even better. When you see some of these people who joined him to celebrate, and it wasn't an overblown kind of thing. Of course, Jan Hammer comes back to play keyboards again, which was great because they did one of my favorite tracks off of 1980s There and Back, Star Cycle, which sounded just as amazing live in 2016 as it did in 1980 when I first heard it on the radio. Steven Tyler comes out and joins Beck for Beck's version of Shapes of Things, because people forget that when he left the Yardbirds, he did his own version with Rod Stewart singing lead, because Rod Stewart was the first lead singer of the Jeff Beck group.
Mm-hmm.
Tyler, first of all, does a damned on-point imitation of Rod Stewart. If you closed your eyes, you actually thought it was Rod.
That's cool.
That's how good Steven Tyler was with it. And, of course, then he did Train Kept a Rollin', right? Billy Gibbons comes out and plays guitar in one song. Buddy Guy comes out and plays guitar in another. You know, Beth Hart, who I worked with at Atlantic Records, and I've loved her since I first heard her, she comes out and joins Jeff Beck and just, you know, she sings lead on Etta James' I'd Rather Go Blind. But what killed me was second song into the show, Over, Under, Sideways, Down, and A Heart Full of Soul, and A For Your Love.
Oh, wow.
Okay. That's all I have to say. Jeff Beck still, these are simple songs, and he still plays them, and they sound so amazing just watching him playing them. And then watching him play, and you know what? He also just plays with his fingers. He
oh, really?
Yeah. I never noticed that before, because I'm pretty sure he was using a pick in the 60s.
Yeah, I think so.
But watching him, no pick. He's playing those riffs and those so he still plays the solos faithfully, and I love the fact that he doesn't fuck around with them. He keeps them pure. Although to me the best moment of the whole show, and it's probably just because of the way I feel about the particular track, was Beck's Bolero.
I was going to ask if he played that. Yeah,
he did it. He did it right after the Yardbirds medley, actually, and. I think there was this kind of look that he gave to the drummer. It was like one of amazement and appreciation. Because let's not forget, the drummer on the original track, even though it's credited to You Know Who on the song, because it's Jeff Beck guitars, Jimmy Page guitars, John Paul Jones bass, and You Know Who on drums.
Right.
Was Keith Moon. So this kid just played Moon's note, you know, drum patterns, note for note, except keeping it completely in time without going loony on it. It was splendid. So this is one of those DVD concerts for the ages that you got to have.
That's
you
cool.
To have this.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to hearing it. And that's the thing is that, you know, when it comes to that economy of being able to do what he does and have it sound amazing, but not be overly flashy for no good reason. He's the master of it. He's the one who built that.
And, you know, people want to hear some of these songs the way that they know them.
Yeah.
You know, he gave it. He gave it to you.
That's
you
cool. Know? That's cool.
And by the way, this DVD comes with a double CD, so you have it in both formats in one package.
Cool. All right. So that's out there and available to you now. And we get to the In Our Head segment. As I said, we're going to go to the movies this time with it instead of sticking with music, because we saw something yesterday that was very... vexing in a number of ways. It's a movie called The Florida Project. Are you familiar with this at all?
No, sir.
Florida Project is it's a movie, the only person who stars, quote-unquote, in this movie is Willem Dafoe. And Willem Dafoe plays a guy who's running a motel along State Road 192, or US 192 in Kissimmee, Florida. Now, anybody who's ever been to Disney or any of the theme parks in Orlando knows that most of the stuff that goes on there is really in Kissimmee, a little ways down the road, down I-4. And 192 is the main drag that goes through town. A few years ago, somebody lost a lion out there. And they had this big thing going on where they sent lion hunters out on 192. And it was crazy. But all of everything that you think about tourist traps in Florida, the plasticky shit and the buildings that are shaped like giant oranges and pink flamingos everywhere and bright neon and places that say free Disney tickets if you take our timeshare tour, that's 192. That's exactly what it is. So what this movie does is it takes a look at the people who actually live there, because these dinky, shitty little motels all along 192, when they're not home to tourists who are there for a couple of days trying to save a couple of bucks by not staying on property at Disney, are home to people who live in these motels. And they're not efficiency apartments. They are actual motels, and they're full of people who can't go anywhere else because they're stuck there. You know, people who have single mothers who have little kids and all of this. And it's a very depressing story, but it's the movie itself has such a realistic take on it. Cause I know a lot of those people, you know, who at one point or another, back when I was a teenager, were living in places like that. And it's not a movie that's designed to depress you. It's not one of those commercials, you know, with the sad looking dogs outside in the cold. It's much more true life than that, and just saying, hey, listen, there is this undercurrent out there. It's not a documentary. I mean, these are actors, you know, but they're saying there's this undercurrent out there of this part of humanity that nobody ever looks at, because everybody there is only there to go see Mickey Mouse. The thing about it is the show is stolen by a girl named Brooklyn Prince, who plays the main character, this woman who is stuck living in this motel. plays her daughter, and she's probably 8 or 9. And holy shit, is this kid a good actor? I mean, I can't imagine somebody that young understanding the emotion that it takes to pull off something like that. And a lot of the movie is spent following her and her little friends around, saying, hey, look, there are little kids involved in all of this, you know, kids who have to live a life and be little kids, and they don't live on streets like you and I lived on. They live in this plastic, fantastic world of US 192. And the dialogue is fantastic. The way the kids interact with each other is spot on. And there is this scene near the end of the movie where this girl is about to be, not to give anything away, but she's about to be taken away by DFS. And because her mother is a fuck up, and it's a long story to get there, but she runs to a friend's house and begins to cry and starts trying to explain to her friend, who is also 8 or 9 years old, what's going on. And it is heartrending. I mean, it's just unbelievable. If for no other reason, I would tell people, watch this movie just to get to that scene, because you will be blown away by the acting skills of a girl who is probably a fifth your age. But, and this is where I want to hand it over to you, what happens after that, and I'm not going to say a word about where the movie goes from that point, but it ends about 5 minutes later in probably the worst way I have ever seen a movie end. And maybe it's one of those things where I don't get it, and it was the director's vision, and it was supposed to make sense in some way that completely eluded me, but the movie has spent an hour and a half being completely real, and in 5 minutes blew itself up. And I thought, shit, I wasted that time. If it hadn't been for the performances in that movie, the little girl notwithstanding, I would have been really pissed that the movie wasted my time to get to that. And so I know over time, being a student of film as you are, that you have had an experience like that where you've seen a movie and you thought, this is kind of fun. This isn't even something I normally watch. This is kind of quirky and cool. And then they rolled credits and you went, fucking really?
You know, I'd like to be able to say right off the top of my head, movies that are like that, but I've seen far too many that just left me shaking my head.
Yeah.
But really too many at this point, because I would say in the last couple of years, mediocrity,
yeah,
as that's way of putting it, has ruled the day. So they're forgettable.
Right.
Now, you bring up one side of a filmmaking that I find a little bit too often when I see something. I'm going to shock you because I'm going to flip it. We picked a movie a couple of weeks ago. It was about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. It was last Saturday now. I can't remember. Called November Criminals.
Okay.
Okay. It stars the young man who was in Baby Driver, the kid who played the driver.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Ansel Elgort or something like that. Mm-hmm. And Chloe Grace Moritz.
Right. She was in Hit Girl.
Right. We're watching her grow up and becoming a fantastic actress.
She really is, yeah.
Much like, what's her name? Hallie Steinfeld, who I think is probably even more amazing, but she's also slightly older.
Yep.
But nonetheless, it stars the two of them. Just to give you the brief synopsis on the storyline, they're two high school friends. They're about to graduate and go off to college. They stop at a coffee shop to see a friend of his. This takes place in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. They see his friend in the coffee shop. Not 5-10 minutes later, after they leave the coffee shop, somebody comes in and shoots the friend and kills him.
Wow.
Okay. So most of the movie is spent with the young man who's, I guess, the protagonist for all intents and purposes, trying to piece together an answer why his friend's murder isn't really being investigated. Mm-hmm. Now it's being written off immediately by the police. B, is this racism? Because of course his friend happens to be black, you know?
Yeah.
The good black kid is killed inexplicably, you know? So you start to get that immediate feeling that all the cliches of social justice warrior styled filmmaking are about to be unfolded before you. And I'm not going to tell you what actually happens, but I, on the flip side, was very pleasantly / happily shocked by the twist, if you want to call it a twist, and this is kind of a sad statement, that you can consider this a twist.
Uh-huh.
So mine was the mirror image of what you got. I walked away from it going, wow, I did not expect that. And I'm really glad that that's what happened. There were moments where also it was a little bit slow and kind of plodding, but it has to be detailed in order to get the clarity across.
Yeah, and that's cool, and you're right. I mean, there are a lot of movies that attempt that, because just about every trope has been played out at this point. So they're trying to figure out any way. I remember seeing a movie about 25 years ago, and I wish I could remember more of the story, but it was a murder mystery where a guy comes down to Florida and finds this, again, the social justice warrior thing. Finds a case where he believes a black man has been falsely imprisoned for murder, and does the, it's in a way, it's kind of like a lot of the stories like, who's the guy that writes all the lawyer books?
Grisham?
Yeah. It's like a lot of the Grisham stories where, you know, here's this guy and he's going to come in and save the day and he's going to make everything all better. And what happens is they do indeed get the conviction overturned. They get the guy out of prison and it turns out he actually fucking did it. And he really is a psychopathic murderer.
Right. It sounds like a lot of the stuff that Gary Oldman was in and Kevin Bacon and all those movies of the early 90s.
Right, right. And so it was one of those, and I was really impressed by the fact that they didn't just go down the same old road we've been down 100 times. But, you know, you mentioned Chloe Grace Moretz, and going back to the girl that's in this movie, The Florida Project, that's something that, you know, when that movie came out, when Kick-Ass came out, and she played Hit Girl in the original Kick-Ass, I thought
the word cunt and all hell broke loose.
Yeah, right. But the thing is, she was great in that movie. I mean, she really was much better than her age would dictate that she should be able to be. And I keep waiting for her to have another really good movie. And it sounds like this one might be it. I will definitely give it a shot. But, you know, sometimes you see those performances. I remember a long time ago going through one of the most brutal film experiences. It's a great movie. But you're sitting there and watching a movie called Bastard Out of Carolina. And you've seen Jenna Malone in that movie. And she's a little kid. She's, again, probably 8 or 9 years old. And the things that she's called upon to do in that movie are something that are beyond the experience of most kids that age. And I was just stunned that she was able to pull it off as well as she was. But then again, since then, she's shown herself to be a pretty damn capable actress.
Well, yeah, that was also a movie filled with a lot of really great talent. Like Diana Scarwig was just she was always a really criminally underappreciated actor. Yep. I always thought she was a massively good performer. She had this natural kind of, you felt an automatic sense of empathy with the characters that she was playing.
Right.
Probably nowhere more so than when she played Christina Crawford.
Right. Not to mention, I mean, Jennifer Jason Leigh and Ronna Eldard, who plays such a great, horrible asshole in that movie.
He's great at playing an asshole.
Yeah,
you know,
really,
I always thought they should pair him up with Tim Roth because they look so much alike.
Yeah.
Just call it twin assholes.
Yeah, the asshole brothers or something. Yeah, definitely.
Have them playing like Russian Jews from Brighton Beach.
Yeah.
You know? And just make them out to be the biggest pair of jerk offs there is. Like run out every cliche you can.
Yep. Yeah.
And make it a comedy.
You know, and the other thing is, I just saw Sam Rockwell in something, and he's that same kind of, you know, he can play anything, but he also plays an asshole so very well.
But he's also good at being charming.
Yeah,
as well.
Right.
I mean, he's unforgettable as what's his name? Guy Fleegman.
Right.
You know, I mean, come on. You know, come on, you have a name. Do I? You only know me as number 6.
Uh-huh.
You know, but he was also terrific in, I can't remember the name of the movie, but he was in that movie where he runs the amusement park at the seaside. It's supposed to take place, I think, in the mid-70s.
Oh, wow, I don't know.
It has Toni Collette and Steve Carell.
Okay.
It's a fantastic movie. I just can't remember the name. I mean, every time I've seen it, I would watch it over and over again. That's how much I liked it. hang on. Let's get this straightened out because we want people to see this movie.
Right,
actually.
Right.
Steve Carell movies, and this is why we look at things like IMDb.
Well, while you're looking, let us not forget he also played the late great Confessions of a Dangerous Mind.
He was playing Chuck Barris.
Chuck Barris, right? He played so in Confessions of a Dangerous Mind.
That was it. The Way Way Back.
The Way Way Back. Okay, all right.
That's a terrific movie.
All right. In that case, I will leave you with one more. I will leave you with one more because it's a movie that I don't think enough people saw. And I think it was one of those labor of love projects for Susan Sarandon. She did a movie going all the way back to Ocean City, once again, oddly enough, called Ping Pong Summer. And it's the story of these two kids who are kind of, again, outcasts in this tourist town, Ocean City, Maryland, which is a place that I used to live right up the beach from. And it's set in, I think, 1985. And that movie gets the tone of 1985 Ocean City, Maryland, flat fucking perfect. I mean, it's amazing. It's like you're there at that time. And I was there at that time, so I know. And it's not a great movie. It's not a big, it's a very small story, as a matter of fact, but it's well worth the hour and a half. And it's, even if you were just that kid who was, you know, in your teens in the mid-80s, you've got to see this movie just so you can step back into that for a little while.
I think it's on cable right now, actually.
Is it really?
I think it's on one of the networks. I swear I've seen it. But you know what? That leaves us then to talk about what we're going to talk about next week, or at least lead into next week, because just before you and I started doing this show, I was able to watch in advance of this Thursday night's premiere. That's the key thing.
Mm-hmm.
The documentary on XTC called This Is Pop.
Yes.
That will be premiering this Thursday night on Showtime. But a very dear friend of mine sent me as his birthday gift to me the actual British print of it. So I watched it. And we'll have a lot to dissect about this, actually.
Good.
Now, we're gonna talk about it because literally just before you and I began our conversation, I had just turned it off. So it's very fresh in my mind, and I'm sure watching it again on Thursday night on a big American TV instead of on a computer screen will, you know.
Yeah.
So that's definitely one to look forward to. And at the same time, we definitely need to talk about this wonderful band from New Jersey called the Rockin' Bricks.
Definitely. So that's on the agenda for next time around. We'll also talk about the David Bowie documentary, David Bowie, The Last 5 Years, which is premiering on HBO tomorrow on Monday. So we'll go into some of the review of that as well.
His birthday.
Yeah.
Tomorrow's his birthday. This is basically the sequel to 5 Years.
5 Years, right. It's the same director, same storyteller. Everything is, yeah, it's just, it's a different look at it. Had a chance to talk to the director for a few minutes on Friday, and I'm really looking forward to this. It's an interesting take, and there's going to be apparently a lot of Tony Visconti in this one.
Which is good because
as well it should be, yeah.
I mean, he's always great for any kind of interviews, whether it's about Bowie or T-Rex or maybe somebody will talk to him about what was it like working with The Damned since he just produced what's going to be their next new studio album.
I'll make a call.
Yeah. Go for it.
You know. All right. Well, Rob Ross, have yourself a brilliant week. And right now, as we speak, the New Orleans Saints are busy dismantling the Carolina Panthers. So we'll see if that holds out. And we'll talk about a week two of the NFL playoffs next time around.
Damn and blast. I want the Panthers to win, believe it or not. I mean, I love New Orleans, but I have a lot of friends in Carolina, so I want to see the Panthers win. Damn it.
We shall see. There's still time. So, Rob Ross,
this is true.
I'll talk to you then, my man.
All right. Have a great week, brother, and take care of yourself.